Voicing, larynx hums, b. No voicing, larynx doesn't hum, p. Tongue tip, voicing, d. No voicing, t. Tongue body, voicing, g. No voicing, k. Speech sounds thus nicely fill the rows and columns and layers of a multidimensional matrix. First, one of the six speech organs is chosen as the major articulator. The larynx, soft palate, tongue body, tongue tip, tongue root, or lips. Second, a manner of moving that articulator is selected. Fricative, stop, or vowel. Third, configurations of the other speech organs can be specified. For the soft palate, nasal or not. For the larynx, voiced or not. For the tongue root, tense or lax. For the lips, rounded or unrounded. Each manner or configuration is a symbol for a set of commands to the speech muscles, and such symbols are called features. To articulate a phoneme, the commands must be executed with precise timing, the most complicated gymnastics we are called upon to perform. English multiplies out enough of these combinations to define 40 phonemes, a bit above the average for the world's languages. Other languages range from 11, Polynesian, to 141, Khoisan, or Bushman. The total inventory of phonemes across the world numbers in the thousands, but they are all defined as combinations of the six speech organs and their shapes and motions. Other mouth sounds are not used in any language. Scraping teeth, clucking the tongue against the floor of the mouth, making raspberries and squawking like Donald Duck, for instance. Even the unusual Khoisan and Bantu clicks, similar to the sound of and made famous by the Hossa pop singer Miriam Makeba, are not miscellaneous phonemes added to those languages. Clicking is a manner of articulation feature, like stop or fricative, and it combines with all the other features to define a new layer of rows and columns in the language's table of phonemes. There are clicks produced by the lips, tongue tip, and tongue body, any of which can be nasalized or not, voiced or not, and so on. As many as 48 click sounds in all. An inventory of phonemes is one of the things that gives a language its characteristic sound pattern. For example, Japanese is famous for not distinguishing R from L. When I arrived in Japan on November 4, 1992, the linguist Masaki Yamanashi greeted me with a twinkle and said, "In Japan, we have been very interested in Clinton's erection." We can often recognize a language's sound pattern even in a speech stream that contains no real words, as with the Swedish chef on The Muppets, or John Belushi's samurai dry cleaner. The linguist Sarah G. Thomason has found that people who claim to be channeling back to past lives or speaking in tongues are really producing gibberish that conforms to a sound pattern vaguely reminiscent of the claimed language. For example, one hypnotized channeler, who claimed to be a 19th century Bulgarian talking to her mother about soldiers laying waste to the countryside, produced generic pseudo-Slavic gobbledygook like this. Ovishta reshta rovishta. Vishne beretishti? Ushne bereshte dashto. Na darish noshto. Korp shnoshkashit. Derishtoi. Au bashni bedepta. And of course, when the words in one language are pronounced with the sound pattern of another, we call it a foreign accent, as in the following excerpt from A Fractured Fairy Tale by Bob Belviso.
Jackie and a Binistocki. Once upon a time was a dis boy. Nemese Jackie. Nice boy. Live with his mama. Mind da cow. One day, the spaghetti is all run out. They're gonna faint from no food. Mama soy race. Oray, Jacques. Take the cow and trade her for a bouquet's spaghetti and some wine. By and by, come se om jacke. I gotta no food, I gotta no wine. Make case a mistake, and a trade is the cow for a bons beans. Jackasse.
What defines the sound patterns of a language? It must be more than just an inventory of phonemes. Consider the following words. Ptak, plaft, vlas, rtut. Thala, sram, flutch, tosp, hlad, mgla, gnom, nyip. All of the phonemes are found in English, but any native speaker recognizes that thala, plaft, and flutch are not English words, but could be, whereas the remaining ones are not English words and could not be. Speakers must have tacit knowledge about how phonemes are strung together in their language. Phonemes are not assembled into words as one-dimensional left-to-right strings. Like words and phrases, they are grouped into units, which are then grouped into bigger units and so on, defining a tree. The group of consonants C at the beginning of a syllable is called an onset. The vowel V and any consonants coming after it are called the rhyme. The rules generating syllables define legal and illegal kinds of words in a language. In English, an onset can consist of a cluster of consonants like flit, thrive, and spring, as long as they follow certain restrictions. For example, vlit and string are impossible. A rhyme can consist of a vowel followed by a consonant or certain clusters of consonants, as in toast, lift, and sixths. In Japanese, in contrast, an onset can have only a single consonant, and a rhyme must be a bare vowel. Hence, strawberry ice cream is translated as sutoberi aisukurimo, girlfriend as garufurendo. Italian allows some clusters of consonants in an onset, but no consonants at the end of a rhyme. Belviso used this constraint to simulate the sound pattern of Italian in the Giacche story. And becomes en, from becomes from, beans becomes bines. Onsets and rhymes not only define the possible sounds of a language, they are the pieces of word sound that are most salient to people, and thus are the units that get manipulated in poetry and word games. Words that rhyme share a rhyme. Words that alliterate share an onset, or just an initial consonant. Pig Latin, eggy peggy, ego pego, and other secret languages of children tend to splice words at onset rhyme boundaries, as does the Yinglish construction in fancy schmancy and Oedipus schmedipus. In the 1964 hit song The Name Game, Noam, noam, bo, boam, banana, fana, fo, foam, fee, fi, fo, moam, noam. Shirley Ellis could have saved several lines in the stanza explaining the rules if she had simply referred to onsets and rhymes. Syllables, in turn, are collected into rhythmic groups called feet. Syllables and feet are classified as strong, S, and weak, W, by other rules, and the pattern of weak and strong branches determines how much stress each syllable will be given when it is pronounced. Feet, like onsets and rhymes, are salient chunks of word that we tend to manipulate in poetry and wordplay. Meter is defined by the kind of feet that go into a line. A succession of feet with a strong, weak pattern is a trochaic meter, as in Mary had a little lamb. A succession with a weak, strong pattern is iambic, as in the rain in Spain falls mainly in the plain. An argot, popular among young ruffians, contains forms like fan-fucking-tastic, abso-bloody-lutely, fill-a-fucking-delphia, and calam-a-fucking-zoo. Ordinarily, expletives appear in front of an emphatically stressed word. Dorothy Parker once replied to a question about why she had not been at the symphony lately by saying, "I've been too fucking busy," and vice versa. But in this lingo, they are placed inside a single word, always in front of a stressed foot. the rule is followed religiously. Philadelphia would get you launched out of the pool hall. The assemblies of phonemes in the morphemes and words stored in memory undergo a series of adjustments before they are actually articulated as sounds, and these adjustments give further definition to the sound pattern of a language. Say the words pat and pad. Now add the inflection ing and pronounce them again. Patting, padding. In many dialects of English, they are now pronounced identically. The original difference between the t and the d has been obliterated. What obliterated them is a phonological rule called flapping. If a stop consonant produced with the tip of the tongue appears between two vowels, the consonant is pronounced by flicking the tongue against the gum ridge, rather than keeping it there long enough for air pressure to build up. Rules like flapping apply not only when two morphemes are joined, like pat and ing. They also apply to one-piece words. For many English speakers, ladder and latter, though they feel like they are made out of different sounds and indeed are represented differently in the mental dictionary, are pronounced the same, except in artificially exaggerated speech. Thus, when cows come up in conversation, often some wag will speak of an utter mystery, an utter success, and so on. Interestingly, phonological rules apply in an ordered sequence, as if words were manufactured on an assembly line. Pronounce right and ride. In most dialects of English, the vowels differ in some way. At the very least, the I in ride is longer than the I in right. In some dialects, like the Canadian English of newscaster Peter Jennings, hockey star Wayne Gretzky, and yours truly, an accent satirized a few years back, in the television characters Bob and Doug McKenzie, the vowels are completely different. Ride contains a diphthong gliding from the vowel in hot to the vowel E. Right contains a diphthong gliding from the higher vowel in hut to E. But regardless of exactly how the vowel is altered, it is altered in a consistent pattern. There are no words with long low I followed by T, nor with short high I followed by D. Using the same logic that allowed Lois Lane in her rare lucid moments to deduce that Clark Kent and Superman were the same, namely that they are never in the same place at the same time, we can infer that there is a single I in the mental dictionary, which is altered by a rule before being pronounced, depending on whether it appears in the company of a T or D. We can even guess that the initial form stored in memory is like the one in ride, and that right is the product of the rule, rather than vice versa. The evidence is that when there is no T or D after the I, as in rye, and thus no rule disguising the underlying form, it is the vowel in ride that we hear. Now pronounce writing and riding. The T and D have been made identical by the flapping rule, but the two I's are still different. How can that be? It is only the difference between T and D that causes a difference between the two I's, and that difference has been erased by the flapping rule. This shows that the rule that alters I must have applied before the flapping rule, while T and D were still distinct. In other words, the two rules apply in a fixed order, vowel change before flapping. Presumably, the ordering comes about because the flapping rule is in some sense there to make articulation easier, and thus is farther downstream in the chain of processing from brain to tongue. Notice another important feature of the vowel-altering rule. The vowel I is altered in front of many different consonants, not just T. Compare prize, price, five, fife, jibe, hype, Geiger, biker. Does this mean there are five different rules that alter I, one for Z versus S, one for V versus F, and so on? Surely not. The change-triggering consonants T, S, F, P, and K all differ in the same way from their counterparts, D, Z, V, B, and G. They are unvoiced, whereas the counterparts are voiced. We need only one rule, then. Change I whenever it appears before an unvoiced consonant. The proof that this is the real rule in people's heads, and not just a way to save ink by replacing five rules with one, is that if an English speaker succeeds in pronouncing the German H in the Third Reich, that speaker will pronounce the EI as in right, not as in ride. The consonant H is not in the English inventory, so English speakers could not have learned any rule specifically applying to it. But it is an unvoiced consonant, and if the rule applies to any unvoiced consonant, an English speaker knows exactly what to do. This selectivity works not only in English but in all languages. Phonological rules are rarely triggered by a single phoneme. They are triggered by an entire class of phonemes that share one or more features, like voicing, stop versus fricative manner, or which organ is doing the articulating. This suggests that rules do not see the phonemes in a string, but instead look right through them to the features they are made from. And it is features, not phonemes, that are manipulated by the rules. Pronounce the following past tense forms: walked, slapped, passed, jogged, sobbed, fizzed. In walked, slapped, and passed, the ED is pronounced as a T. In jogged, sobbed, and fizzed, it is pronounced as a D. By now you can probably figure out what is behind the difference. The T pronunciation comes after voiceless consonants like K, P, and S. The D comes after voiced ones like G, B, and Z. There must be a rule that adjusts the pronunciation of the suffix ed by peering back into the final phoneme of the stem and checking to see if it has the voicing feature. We can confirm the hunch by asking people to pronounce Mozart outbacht Bach. The verb to outbach contains the sound h, which does not exist in English. Nonetheless, everyone pronounces the ed as a t because the h is unvoiced, and the rule puts a t next to any unvoiced consonant. We can even determine whether people store the ed suffix as a t in memory, and use the rule to convert it to a d for some words, or the other way around. Words like play and row have no consonant at the end, and everyone pronounces their past tenses like played and rowed, not plate and wrote. With no stem consonant triggering a rule, we must be hearing the suffix in its pure, unaltered form in the mental dictionary, that is, d. It is a nice demonstration of one of the main discoveries of modern linguistics. A morpheme may be stored in the mental dictionary in a different form from the one that is ultimately pronounced. Listeners with a taste for theoretical elegance may want to bear with me for one more paragraph. Note that there is an uncanny pattern in what the D to T rule is doing. First, D itself is voiced, and it ends up next to voiced consonants, whereas T is unvoiced, and it ends up next to unvoiced consonants. Second, except for voicing, T and D are the same. They use the same speech organ, the tongue tip, and that organ moves in the same way, namely sealing up the mouth at the gum ridge and then releasing. So the rule is not just tossing phonemes around arbitrarily, like changing a P to an L following a high vowel, or any other substitution one might pick at random. It is doing delicate surgery on the ed suffix, adjusting it to be the same in voicing as its neighbor, but leaving the rest of its features alone. That is, in converting slap plus ed to slapped, the rule is spreading the voicing instruction, packaged with the P at the end of slap onto the ed suffix. The voicelessness of the T in slapped matches the voicelessness of the P in slapped because they are the same voicelessness. They are mentally represented as a single feature linked to two segments. This happens very often in the world's languages. Features like voicing, vowel quality, and tones can spread sideways or sprout connections to several phonemes in a word, as if each feature lived on its own horizontal tier, rather than being tethered to one and only one phoneme. So, phonological rules see features, not phonemes, and they adjust features, not phonemes. Recall, too, that languages tend to arrive at an inventory of phonemes by multiplying out the various combinations of some set of features. These facts show that features, not phonemes, are the atoms of linguistic sounds stored and manipulated in the brain. A phoneme is merely a bundle of features. Thus, even in dealing with its smallest units, the features, language works by using a combinatorial system. Every language has phonological rules. But what are they for? You may have noticed that they often make articulation easier. Flapping a T or a D between two vowels is faster than keeping the tongue in place long enough for air pressure to build up. Spreading voicelessness from the end of a word to its suffix spares the talker from having to turn the larynx off while pronouncing the end of the stem, and then turn it back on again for the suffix. At first glance, phonological rules seem to be a mere summary of articulatory laziness, and from here it is a small step to notice phonological adjustments in some dialect other than one's own, and conclude that they typify the slovenliness of the speakers. Neither side of the Atlantic is safe. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "The English have no respect for their language and will not teach their children to speak it. They cannot spell it because they have nothing to spell it with but an old foreign alphabet of which only the consonants, and not all of them, have any agreed speech value. Consequently, it is impossible for an Englishman to open his mouth without making some other Englishman despise him." In his article, How to Recognize American Slurvian, Richard Lederer writes, "Language lovers have long bewailed the sad state of pronunciation and articulation in the United States. Both in sorrow and in anger, speakers afflicted with sensitive ears wince at such mumblings as government for government and accessories for accessories. Indeed, everywhere we turn, we are assaulted by a slew of slurrings." But if their ears were even more sensitive, these sorrowful speakers might notice that, in fact, there is no dialect in which sloppiness prevails. Phonological rules give with one hand and take away with the other. The same bumpkins who are derided for dropping G's in nothin' doin' are likely to enunciate the vowels in police and accident that pointy-headed intellectuals reduce to a neutral sound. When the Brooklyn Dodgers pitcher Wade Hoyt was hit by a ball, a fan in the bleachers shouted, "Hurts Hoyt!" Bostonians who park their car in Harvard Yard name their daughters Sheila and Linder. In 1992, an ordinance was proposed that would have banned the hiring of any immigrant teacher who speaks with an accent in, I am not making this up, Westfield, Massachusetts. An incredulous woman wrote to the Boston Globe recalling how her native New England teacher defined homonym, using the examples orphan and often. Another amused reader remembered incurring the teacher's wrath when he spelled Korea, K-O-R-E-A, and career, C-A-R-E-E-R, rather than vice versa. The proposal was quickly withdrawn. There is a good reason why so-called laziness in pronunciation is in fact tightly regulated by phonological rules, and why, as a consequence, no dialect allows its speakers to cut corners at will. Every act of sloppiness on the part of a speaker demands a compensating measure of mental effort on the part of the conversational partner. A society of lazy talkers would be a society of hard-working listeners. If speakers were to have their way, all rules of phonology would spread and reduce and delete. But if listeners were to have their way, Phonology would do the opposite. It would enhance the acoustic differences between confusable phonemes by forcing speakers to exaggerate or embroider them. And indeed, many rules of phonology do that. For example, there is a rule that forces English speakers to round their lips while saying sh, but not while saying s. The benefit of forcing everyone to make this extra gesture is that the long resonant chamber formed by the pursed lips enhances the lower frequency noise that distinguishes sh from s, allowing for easier identification of the sh by the listener. Although every speaker soon becomes a listener, human hypocrisy would make it unwise to depend on the speaker's foresight and consideration. Instead, a single, partly arbitrary set of phonological rules, some reducing, some enhancing, is adopted by every member of a linguistic community when he or she acquires the local dialect as a child. Phonological rules help listeners even when they do not exaggerate some acoustic difference. By making speech patterns predictable, they add redundancy to a language. English text has been estimated as being between 2 and 4 times as long as it has to be for its information content. For example, this book takes up about 900,000 characters on my computer disk, but my file compression program can exploit the redundancy in the letter sequences and squeeze it into about 400,000 characters. Computer files that do not contain English text cannot be squished nearly that much. The logician Quine explains why many systems have redundancy built in. It is the judicious excess over minimum requisite support. It is why a good bridge does not crumble when subjected to stress beyond what reasonably could have been foreseen. It is fallback and fail-safe. It is why we address our mail to city and state in so many words, despite the zip code. One indistinct digit in the zip code would spoil everything. A kingdom, legend tells us, was lost for want of a horseshoe nail. Redundancy is our safeguard against such instability. Thanks to the redundancy of language, you can understand what I am writing even if it replaces all the vowels with an X. It gets a little harder if you don't know where the vowels are. In the comprehension of speech, the redundancy conferred by phonological rules can compensate for some of the ambiguity in the sound wave. For example, a listener can know that this rip must be this rip, not the srip, because the English consonant cluster SR is illegal. So why is it that a nation that can put a man on the moon cannot build a computer that can take dictation? According to what I have explained so far, each phoneme should have a telltale acoustic signature, a set of resonances for vowels, a noise band for fricatives, a silence burst transition sequence for stops. The sequences of phonemes are massaged in predictable ways by ordered phonological rules, whose effects could presumably be undone by applying them in reverse. The reason that speech recognition is so hard is that there's many a slip twixt brain and lip. No two people's voices are alike, either in the shape of the vocal tract that sculpts the sounds or in the person's precise habits of articulation. Phonemes also sound very different depending on how much they are stressed and how quickly they are spoken. In rapid speech, many are swallowed outright. But the main reason an electric stenographer is not just around the corner has to do with a general phenomenon in muscle control called co-articulation. Put a saucer in front of you and a coffee cup a foot or so away from it on one side. Now, quickly touch the saucer and pick up the cup. You probably touch the saucer at the edge nearest the cup, not dead center. Your fingers probably assumed the handle grasping posture while your hand was making its way to the cup well before it arrived. This graceful smoothing and overlapping of gestures is ubiquitous in motor control. It reduces the forces necessary to move body parts around and lessens the wear and tear on the joints. The tongue and throat are no different. When we want to articulate a phoneme, Our tongue cannot assume the target posture instantaneously. It is a heavy slab of meat that takes time to heft into place. So while we are moving it, our brains are anticipating the next posture and planning the trajectory, just like the cup and saucer maneuver. Among the range of positions in the mouth that can define a phoneme, we place the tongue in the one that offers the shortest path to the target for the next phoneme. If the current phoneme does not specify where a speech organ should be, we anticipate where the next phoneme wants it to be and put it there in advance. Most of us are completely unaware of these adjustments until they are called to our attention. Say, Cape Cod. Until now, you probably never noticed that your tongue body is in different positions for the two K sounds. In horseshoe, the first S becomes a sh. In NPR, the N becomes an M. In month and width, the N and D are articulated at the teeth, not the usual gum ridge. Because sound waves are minutely sensitive to the shapes of the cavities they pass through, this co-articulation wreaks havoc with the speech sound. Each phoneme's sound signature is colored by the phonemes that come before and after, sometimes to the point of having nothing in common with its sound signature in the company of a different set of phonemes. That is why you cannot cut up a tape of the sound cat and hope to find a beginning piece that contains the K alone. As you make earlier and earlier cuts, the piece may go from sounding like ka to sounding like a chirp or whistle. This shingling of phonemes in the speech stream could, in principle, be a boon to an optimally designed speech recognizer. Consonants and vowels are being signaled simultaneously, greatly increasing the rate of phonemes per second, as I noted at the beginning of this chapter, and there are many redundant sound cues to a given phoneme. But this advantage can be enjoyed only by a high-tech speech recognizer, one that has some kind of knowledge of how vocal tracts blend sounds. The human brain, of course, is a high-tech speech recognizer, but no one knows how it succeeds. For this reason, psychologists who study speech perception and engineers who build speech recognition machines keep a close eye on each other's work. Speech recognition may be so hard that there are only a few ways it could be solved in principle. If so, the way the brain does it may offer hints as to the best way to build a machine to do it, and how a successful machine does it may suggest hypotheses about how the brain does it. Early in the history of speech research, it became clear that human listeners might somehow take advantage of their expectations of the kinds of things a speaker is likely to say. This could narrow down the alternatives left open by the acoustic analysis of the speech signal. We have already noted that the rules of phonology provide one sort of redundancy that can be exploited, but people might go even farther. The psychologist George Miller played tapes of sentences in background noise and asked people to repeat back exactly what they heard. Some of the sentences followed the rules of English syntax and made sense. Furry wildcats fight furious battles. Respectable jewelers give accurate appraisals. Lighted cigarettes create smoky fumes. Gallant gentlemen save distressed damsels. Soapy detergents dissolve greasy stains. Others were created by scrambling the words within phrases to create colorless green ideas, sentences, grammatical but nonsensical. Furry jewelers create distressed stains. Respectable cigarettes save greasy battles. Lighted gentlemen dissolve furious appraisals. Gallant detergents fight accurate fumes. Soapy wildcats give smoky damsels. A third kind was created by scrambling the phrase structure but keeping related words together, as in furry fight furious wildcat battles. Jewelers respectable appraisals accurate give. Finally, some sentences were utter word salad, like furry create distressed jewelers stains. Cigarettes respectable battles greasy save. People did best with the grammatical, sensible sentences, worse with the grammatical nonsense and the ungrammatical sense, and worst of all, with the ungrammatical nonsense. A few years later, the psychologist Richard Warren taped sentences like, "The state governors met with their respective legislatures convening in the capital city," excised the first S from legislatures, and spliced in a cough. Listeners could not tell that any sound was missing. If one thinks of the sound wave as sitting at the bottom of a hierarchy from sounds to phonemes to words to phrases to the meanings of sentences to general knowledge, these demonstrations seem to imply that human speech perception works from the top down, rather than just from the bottom up. Maybe we are constantly guessing what a speaker will say next, using every scrap of conscious and unconscious knowledge at our disposal, from how co-articulation distorts sounds, to the rules of English phonology, to the rules of English syntax, to stereotypes about who tends to do what to whom in the world, to hunches about what our conversational partner has in mind at that very moment. If the expectations are accurate enough, the acoustic analysis can be fairly crude. What the sound wave lacks, the context can fill in. For example, if you are listening to a discussion about the destruction of ecological habitats, you might be on the lookout for words pertaining to threatened animals and plants, and then when you hear speech sounds whose phonemes you cannot pick out, like "eces," you would perceive it correctly as "species." Unless you are Emily Letella, the hearing-impaired editorialist on Saturday Night Live, who argued passionately against the campaign to protect endangered feces. Indeed, the humor in the Gilda Radner character, who also fulminated against saving Soviet jewelry, stopping violins in the streets, and preserving natural racehorses, comes not from her impairment at the bottom of the speech processing system, but from her ditziness at the top, the level that should have prevented her from arriving at her interpretations. The top-down theory of speech perception exerts a powerful emotional tug on some people. It confirms the relativist philosophy that we hear what we expect to hear, that our knowledge determines our perception, and ultimately that we are not in direct contact with any objective reality. In a sense, perception that is strongly driven from the top down would be a barely controlled hallucination. And that is the problem. A perceiver forced to rely on its expectations is at a severe disadvantage in a world that is unpredictable even under the best of circumstances. There is a reason to believe that human speech perception is, in fact, driven quite strongly by acoustics. If you have an indulgent friend, you can try the following experiment. Pick 10 words at random out of a dictionary, phone up the friend, and say the words clearly. Chances are the friend will reproduce them perfectly, relying only on the information in the sound wave and knowledge of English vocabulary and phonology. The friend could not have been using any higher-level expectations about phrase structure, context, or storyline, because a list of words blurted out of the blue has none. Though we may call upon high-level conceptual knowledge in noisy or degraded circumstances, and even here it is not clear whether the knowledge alters perception or just allows us to guess intelligently after the fact, our brains seem designed to squeeze every last drop of phonetic information out of the sound wave itself. Our sixth sense may perceive speech as language, not as sound, but it is a sense, something that connects us to the world, and not just a form of suggestibility. Another demonstration that speech perception is not the same thing as fleshing out expectations comes from an illusion that the columnist John Carroll has called the Mondegreen, after his mishearing of the folk ballad, "The Bonny Earl o' Moray." "O ye highlands and ye lowlands, O where hae ye been? They have slain the Earl of Moray, and laid him on the green." He had always thought that the lines were, "They have slain the Earl of Moray and Lady Mondegreen." Mondegreens are fairly common. They are an extreme version of the Pullet surprises and Pennsylvanias mentioned earlier. Here are some examples. A girl with colitis goes by. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes, from the Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Lead us not into Penn Station. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Lead us not into temptation. From the Lord's Prayer. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes are wrapped and stored. Grapes of wrath are stored, from the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Gladly the cross-eyed bear. Gladly the cross-eyed bear. I'll never be your pizza burnin', your beast of burden, from the Rolling Stones song. It's a happy enchilada, and you think you're gonna drown. It's a half an inch of water. From the John Prine song, That's the Way the World Goes Round. The interesting thing about Mondegreens is that the mishearings are generally less plausible than the intended lyrics. In no way do they bear out any sane listener's general expectations of what a speaker is likely to say or mean. In one case, a student stubbornly misheard the Shocking Blue hit song, I'm Your Venus, as I'm Your Penis, and wondered how it was allowed on the radio. The Mondegreens do conform to English phonology, English syntax sometimes, and English vocabulary, though not always, as in the word Mondegreen itself. Apparently, listeners lock in to some set of words that fit the sound and that hang together more or less as English words and phrases, but plausibility and general expectations are not running the show. The history of artificial speech recognizers offers a similar moral. In the 1970s, a team of artificial intelligence researchers at Carnegie Mellon University, headed by Raj Reddy, designed a computer program called Hearsay that interpreted spoken commands to move chess pieces. Influenced by the top-down theory of speech perception, they designed a program as a community of expert sub-programs, cooperating to give the most likely interpretation of the signal. There were sub-programs that specialized in acoustic analysis, in phonology, in the dictionary, in syntax, in rules for the legal moves of chess, even in chess strategy as applied to the game in progress. According to one story, a general from the defense agency that was funding the research came up for a demonstration. As the scientists sweated, he was seated in front of a chessboard and a microphone hooked up to the computer. The general cleared his throat. The program printed, Pawn to King 4. The recent program, Dragon Dictate, mentioned earlier in the chapter, places the burden more on good acoustic, phonological, and lexical analyses, and that seems to be responsible for its greater success. The program has a dictionary of words and their sequences of phonemes. To help anticipate the effects of phonological rules and co-articulation, the program is told what every English phoneme sounds like in the context of every possible preceding phoneme and every possible following phoneme. For each word, these phonemes in context are arranged into a little chain, with a probability attached to each transition from one sound unit to the next. This chain serves as a crude model of the speaker, and when a real speaker uses the system, the probabilities in the chain are adjusted to capture that person's manner of speaking. The entire word, too, has a probability attached to it, which depends on its frequency in the language and on the speaker's habits. In some versions of the program, the probability value for a word is adjusted depending on which word precedes it. This is the only top-down information that the program uses. All this knowledge allows the program to calculate which word is most likely to have come out of the mouth of the speaker given the input sound. Even then, Dragon Dictate relies more on expectancies than an able-eared human does. In the demonstration I saw, the program had to be coaxed into recognizing word and worm, even when they were pronounced as clear as a bell, because it kept playing the odds and guessing higher frequency were instead. Now that you know how individual speech units are produced, how they are represented in the mental dictionary, and how they are rearranged and smeared before they emerge from the mouth, you have reached the prize at the bottom of this chapter. Why English spelling is not as deranged as it first appears. The complaint about English spelling, of course, is that it pretends to capture the sounds of words, but does not. There is a long tradition of doggerel making this point, of which this stanza is a typical example. Beware of heard, a dreadful word, that looks like beard and sounds like bird. And dead, it's said like bed, not bead. For goodness sake, don't call it deed. Watch out for meat and great and threat. They rhyme with sweet and straight and debt. George Bernard Shaw led a vigorous campaign to reform the English alphabet, a system so illogical, he said, that it could spell fish as goatee, G-H as in tough, O as in women, T-I as in nation, M-N-O-M-N-O-U-P-T-E for minute, and M-N-O-P-S-P-T-E-I-C-H-E for mistake are other examples. In his will, Shaw bequeathed a cash prize to be awarded to the designer of a replacement alphabet for English, in which each sound in the spoken language would be recognizable by a single symbol. He wrote, "To realize the annual difference in favor of a 42-letter phonetic alphabet, you must multiply the number of minutes in the year, the number of people in the world who are continuously writing English words, casting types, manufacturing printing and writing machines, by which time the total figure will have become so astronomical that you will realize that the cost of spelling even one sound with two letters has cost us centuries of unnecessary labor. A new British 42-letter alphabet would pay for itself a million times over, not only in hours, but in moments. When this is grasped, all the useless twaddle about enough and cough and laugh and simplified spelling will be dropped, and the economists and statisticians will be set to work to gather in the orthographic Golconda." My defense of English spelling will be half-hearted. For although language is an instinct, written language is not. Writing was invented a small number of times in history, and alphabetic writing, where one character corresponds to one sound, seems to have been invented only once. Most societies have lacked written language, and those that have it inherited it or borrowed it from one of the inventors. Children must be taught to read and write in laborious lessons, and knowledge of spelling involves no daring leaps from the training examples like the leaps we saw in Simon, Myella, and the Jabba and Mice Eater experiments in chapters 3 and 5. And people do not uniformly succeed. Illiteracy, the result of insufficient teaching, is the rule in much of the world. And dyslexia, a presumed congenital difficulty in learning to read even with sufficient teaching, is a severe problem even in industrial societies, found in 5 to 10% of the population. But though writing is an artificial contraption connecting vision and language, it must tap into the language system at well-demarcated points, and that gives it a modicum of logic. In all known writing systems, the symbols designate only 3 kinds of linguistic structure: the morpheme, the syllable, and the phoneme. Mesopotamian cuneiform, Egyptian hieroglyphs, Chinese logograms, and Japanese kanji encode morphemes. Cherokee, ancient Cypriot, and Japanese kana are syllable-based. All modern phonemic alphabets appear to be descended from a system invented by the Canaanites around 1700 BC. No writing system has symbols for actual sound units that can be identified on an oscilloscope or spectrogram, such as a phoneme as it is pronounced in a particular context, or a syllable chopped in half. Why has no writing system ever met Shaw's ideal of one symbol per sound? As Shaw himself said elsewhere, "There are 2 tragedies in life. One is not to get your heart's desire. The other is to get it. Just think back to the workings of phonology and coarticulation. A true Shavian alphabet would mandate different vowels in write and ride, different consonants in write and writing, and different spellings for the past tense suffix in slapped, sobbed, and sorted. Cape Cod would lose its visual alliteration. A horse would be spelled differently from its horseshoe, and National Public Radio would have the enigmatic abbreviation MPR. We would need brand new letters for the N in month and the D in width. I would spell often differently from orphan, but my neighbors here in the hub would not, and their spelling of career would be my spelling of Korea, and vice versa. Obviously, alphabets do not and should not correspond to sounds. At best, they correspond to the phonemes specified in the mental dictionary. The actual sounds are different in different contexts, so true phonetic spelling would only obscure their underlying identity. The surface sounds are predictable by phonological rules, though, so there is no need to clutter up the page with symbols for the actual sounds. The reader needs only the abstract blueprint for a word and can flesh out the sound if needed. Indeed, for about 84% of English words, spelling is completely predictable from regular rules. Moreover, since dialects separated by time and space often differ most in the phonological rules that convert mental dictionary entries into pronunciations, a spelling corresponding to the underlying entries, not the sounds, can be widely shared. The words with truly weird spellings, like of, people, women, have, said, do, done, and give, generally are the commonest ones in the language, so there is ample opportunity for everyone to memorize them. Even the less predictable aspects of spelling bespeak hidden linguistic regularities. Consider the following pairs of words where the same letters get different pronunciations. Electric, electricity. Photograph, photography. Grade, gradual. History, historical. Revise, revision. Adore, adoration. Bomb, bombard. Nation, national. Critical, criticize. Mode, modular. Resident, residential. Declare, declaration. Muscle, muscular. Condemn, condemnation. Courage, courageous. Romantic, romanticize. Industry, industrial. Fact, factual. Inspire, inspiration. Sign, signature. Malign, malignant. Once again, the similar spellings, despite differences in pronunciation, are there for a reason. They are identifying two words as being based on the same root morpheme. This shows that English spelling is not completely phonemic. Sometimes letters encode phonemes, but sometimes a sequence of letters is specific to a morpheme. And a morphemic writing system is more useful than you might think. The goal of reading, after all, is to understand the text, not to pronounce it. A morphemic spelling can help a reader distinguishing homophones like M-E-E-T and M-E-T-E. It can also tip off a reader that one word contains another, and not just a phonologically identical imposter. For example, spelling tells us that overcome contains come, so we know that its past tense must be overcame. Whereas succumb just contains the sound come, not the morpheme C-O-M-E, so its past tense is not succame, but succumbed. Similarly, when something recedes, one has a recession. But when someone recedes a lawn, we have a receding. In some ways, a morphemic writing system has served the Chinese well, despite the inherent disadvantage that readers are at a loss when they face a new or rare word. Mutually unintelligible dialects can share texts, even if their speakers pronounce the words very differently. And many documents that are thousands of years old are readable by modern speakers. Mark Twain alluded to such inertia in our own Roman writing system when he wrote, "They spell it Vinci and pronounce it Vinci. Foreigners always spell better than they pronounce." Of course, English spelling could be better than it is, but it is already much better than people think it is. That is because writing systems do not aim to represent the actual sounds of talking, which we do not hear, but the abstract units of language underlying them, which we do hear. Chapter 7. Talking Heads. For centuries, people have been terrified that their programmed creations might outsmart them, overpower them, or put them out of work. The fear has long been played out in fiction, from the medieval Jewish legend of the golem, a clay automaton animated by an inscription of the name of God placed in its mouth, to HAL, the mutinous computer of 2001, a space odyssey. But when the branch of engineering called artificial intelligence, AI, was born in the 1950s, it looked as though fiction was about to turn into frightening fact. It is easy to accept a computer calculating pi to a million decimal places or keeping track of a company's payroll, but suddenly computers were also proving theorems in logic and playing respectable chess. In the years following, there came computers that could beat anyone but a grandmaster, and programs that outperformed most experts at recommending treatments for bacterial infections and investing pension funds. With computers solving such brainy tasks, it seemed only a matter of time before a C-3PO or a Terminator would be available from the mail order catalogs. Only the easy tasks remained to be programmed. According to legend, in the 1970s, Marvin Minsky, one of the founders of AI, assigned vision to a graduate student as a summer project. But household robots are still confined to science fiction. The main lesson of 35 years of AI research is that the hard problems are easy, and the easy problems are hard. The mental abilities of a 4-year-old that we take for granted, recognizing a face, lifting a pencil, walking across a room, answering a question, in fact solves some of the hardest engineering problems ever conceived. Do not be fooled by the assembly line robots in the automobile commercials. All they do is weld and spray paint, tasks that do not require these clumsy Mr. Magoos to see or hold or place anything. And if you want to stump an artificial intelligence system, ask it questions like, which is bigger, Chicago or a bread box? Do zebras wear underwear? Is the floor likely to rise up and bite you? If Susan goes to the store, does her head go with her? Most fears of automation are misplaced. As the new generation of intelligent devices appears, it will be the stock analysts and petrochemical engineers and parole board members who are in danger of being replaced by machines. The gardeners, receptionists, and cooks are secure in their jobs for decades to come. Understanding a sentence is one of these hard, easy problems. To interact with computers, we still have to learn their languages. They are not smart enough to learn ours. In fact, it is all too easy to give computers more credit at understanding than they deserve. Recently, an annual competition was set up for the computer program that can best fool users into thinking that they are conversing with another human. The competition for the Loebner Prize was intended to implement a suggestion made by Alan Turing in a famous 1950 paper. He suggested that the philosophical question, "Can machines think?" could best be answered in an imitation game, where a judge converses with a person over one terminal and with the computer programmed to imitate a person on another. If the judge cannot guess which is which, Turing suggested, there is no basis for denying that the computer can think. Philosophical questions aside, it was apparent to the committee charged with overseeing the competition that no program could come close to winning the $100,000 prize, so they devised a $1,500 version that would be fairer to the state of the art. Each of the judges had to stick to a single topic of conversation selected by the programmer or by the human foil, whichever it was, and the judge was not allowed to engage in any trickery or guile, such as repeating a question 10 times, or asking whether zebras wear underwear. The conversation had to be natural.